Hello, Adam Kinzinger. I got it, right? The last, the G?
Yep, perfect. Good job.
How are you doing today? I'm so excited for you to
join us. I'm good. I'm good. I never know how to answer those. Like, I'm good. The country's on fire, but I'm good.
So me and my audience, I'm going to fast forward through a lot of stuff. I don't know if you're familiar with any of my online content at all. A little bit. Okay. So I had a huge awakening where I think there were a lot of people who in 2016, we hated Trump. And then maybe we felt like we got a little bit of Trump derangement syndrome. 2021, 2022 rolls around. And then at the urging of a friend, I pick up and I decide to read through the 970-page January 6th Select Committee report. And then I have this huge moment of, oh my God, everything was so much worse than I could have ever imagined. And then I'm sure you get a lot of people that do this. I don't do this kind of stuff often, but I really genuinely want to say I am so in awe that you and Liz, against so much of the world, right? Your entire world, your entire political party. I'm sure, I mean, you mentioned it. We watched the documentary that was made, The Last Republican. People in your personal life, people that I'm sure you never could have imagined fighting with, that you decided to take up that fight. It was just such an unbelievably heroic act. So I just want to say thank you genuinely for the first part of that. Yeah.
Well, yeah, thanks for saying that. You know, it's and I appreciate it a lot. And it was hard, right? Like, I'm not downplaying that. But I think the thing that still kind of gets me on it is I always just assumed that the second I took an oath, like, what I did was basically what was required of me. And it's always amazing, but also like extremely disheartening to see that so many of my colleagues just went along with it. And even though in the dark rooms they'd whisper like, oh yeah, I agree with you. But like, it's, you know, history is a real thing. People are going to read back at this time. And Kinzinger's a name that doesn't hide very well. So my son, you know, if he comes to me and talks about, hey, what does it mean to do the right thing? And I, you know, just went along with evil, it would be pretty hard to give him that example.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely intellectually understand what you're saying, but emotionally, I mean, obviously we can look at the Congress today and see that it's a whole different ballgame in terms of what path do people actually take. There's two big topics that I kind of want to hit on. The second one, we'll get to later, but it's basically like, what do you think the country needs to do going forward to heal? Okay, so keep this in the back of your mind. And then for the first one, there's this like, it's very hard to tell sometimes when I see people. There are people that I've got grouped off. I call these like the tier one kind of influencers and the tier two kind of influencers, where you have people that legitimately believe everything that's being said. I'm sorry, those are the tier two. And then tier one people are the people that are kind of like selling a lie and they know that they're lying about things. Now, I'm not going to say anything to call names or anything, but when you're in Congress, when you see how a lot of this stuff is going down with, like, I would say that the current administration is engaged in just so many blatant lies. When it comes to, like, the congressmen, the staffers, and the people that are actually at the Capitol, like, do a lot of them, like, how do they sell this to themselves? Do they genuinely believe it? Do they think the other side lies just as much? Do they see it as like a necessary evil or as a temporary bargain with Satan? Like, what is the thought process there? I'm curious.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's kind of all of it. So I think it started out, if you would have asked me after January 6th, like with that current Congress, what percent of the members of Congress on the Republican side actually believed the election was stolen? I would say 1% maybe. Nothing, right? But they were going along with it. Now get into how they can do that. Now, though, I think, you know, you look at Donald Trump's been in our life 10 years, which is insane. And he has completely remade the party. And so anybody that had the ability to resist, the desire to resist, the desire for even independence, they've been either defeated, decided not to run again, weeded out, timed out, whatever. And they're being replaced by true believers. The people that were there on January 6th, at least in spirit. And so how do people then that know better convince themselves? And it's like, look, and I'm not making the comparison to Nazi Germany, but I think Nazi Germany's, it provides so many examples. Like, how does a guy in 1936 who works at a factory end up 7 years later guarding a tower in Auschwitz? Because the 1936 version of that guy never would. And it's just you slowly convince yourself over time that what you're doing is for a greater good. You convince yourself that you're in a holy war, right? I mean, if all of a sudden you're fighting on behalf of Jesus Christ, my goodness, then what do you do? Well, any white lie is okay. And then humans, as a way to cope with that inherent distraction or inherent conflict, you can convince yourself that what you're doing is right and what you're doing is okay. And look, the Democrats, they believe in these terrible things. And Donald Trump, yeah, he's an imperfect vessel, but he's who God sent now. And I think over 10 years of those tiny compromises, those tiny bargains, you get to a point where it's okay. And then eventually, once you accept January 6th, for God's sakes, then you can accept anything. And I think, I mean, we could do a one-hour episode on different stories I know of people that have gotten to this position. Let's just take a quick example. Mike Waltz, you know, who's now the UN ambassador. He was an anti-Trumper in 2016. He and I became friends. He gets elected to Congress. I thought that his addition to Congress was going to be great for a sane Republican. And he flies home on Air Force One and boom, transformation complete. Presence to power, proximity to power, changes a lot of people too.
I mean, in the J6 report you guys had, I remember when the Capitol was being broken into, and you've got the calls that are going back and forth between Trump and members of Congress. I distinctly remember the conversation that McCarthy was having with him about, your followers want to kill me, and he's like, well, they're more upset than you are, you know. And one thing that I really vibed with in The Last Republican, in the documentary that you filmed, was this idea that immediately after the J6 stuff, it kind of seemed like there was this moment of, okay, maybe this kind of stuff was not good and this is like a bad thing. I think McConnell really messed up not convicting in the Senate. My feeling at the time, I guess you would know, is I feel like the Republicans thought, the lawmakers thought that Trump just couldn't run again. You can't run after losing. And so they're like, we don't have to worry about this. And my God, what a horrible gamble that was.
Yeah,
but to see, everybody slowly hop back on the train, and then, I mean, like, I mentioned McCarthy, you bring up a story, like, we've seen Lindsey Graham, you know, make statements before. There's just so much hypocrisy.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Please.
No, your words are more important than mine. Go for it.
I mean, the thing that always stands out to me about that, and I'm glad you saw that in the movie, because this is the thing that haunts me. Not that I didn't do everything I could. I feel like I did. Maybe I could do stuff differently. But after January 6th, I mean, so you go into what's called conference, and it's basically all the Republican members of Congress when we all meet up, right? Democrats have a conference too. And it's just like crickets in that room for 3 weeks when we go in. People don't know what to say. They don't know how to act. I was one of the few that was like, guys, this is BS, man. We've got to break away from this. We have to apologize to the American people, say it got out of hand. And it's not like everybody in that room was booing me. They were kind of like, I actually made an attempt, and unfortunately it kind of fell flat, because the one criticism I'd give to the other people that voted to impeach with me is they were like, it's over. It's time to heal the party. But I wanted to do a vote of no confidence on Kevin McCarthy and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, so that 3 weeks, it's crickets. I mean, keep in mind, nobody was at Andrews when Donald Trump left his last day of the presidency. He goes, you know, gets on the plane, leaves during the inauguration. Nobody besides his family is even there to wish him off. And so that tells you where the headspace was. But 3 weeks later, without anybody taking leadership in that vacuum, and I tried, but I wasn't high enough rank, all of a sudden Kevin McCarthy goes to Mar-a-Lago. And the decision is made, we have to embrace the Trump people, because if we try to defeat them in this next year or so, I'll never become speaker. If I embrace them, it's harmless, because Trump is certainly gone and never going to happen again in our life, and I don't create fissures. Though there are so many points in this history that I can look back and say, if only, and that is clearly one of them. We were ready to crap Donald Trump, you know, out of our butts into the public toilet of history, but just nobody had the courage to actually do it.
It's so funny, because as politics has gone on, I say funny, it's actually really depressing. I've switched from kind of political analysis to more just kind of, I call it influencer analysis, because I really do feel like the politics of DC and the United States in general now are just, they can all be seen through the frame of how do YouTubers or online personalities act. And it's funny because one of the huge complaints that I'll have sometimes is there will be a large internet figure, and then they will do a thing, and their community will have a response where I feel like the community response is not good. And as an influencer, YouTuber, streamer, whatever, you always have two choices. You can either go with what they're demanding, and so you kind of follow, mm-hmm. you let your community push you around, or you can push back. Usually you'll lose a couple people, but you're shaping a better community, and then in the long run, hopefully you're shaping more. And you know, one of the big frustrations I have with the Republican Party is kind of what you just said. There would be some friction to dump kind of the MAGA movement. Like, it would be a little painful for a little bit, but ideally in the long term it would be good. But if enough people are willing to say, let's just ride this out and kind of like follow the wave and see where everything goes, you just end up in this scenario where instead of being a leader, you're constantly just following the loudest person in the room, which if it's Donald Trump, I would say is a really bad idea.
Mm-hmm. And you put a layer onto that, which is, you know, we do look at politicians, in particular the president, as our leaders. We like to, as Americans, pretend like we're, you know, yeah, politics is crazy, but, you know, we're all independent. No, leaders do set the tone for the culture. And I've looked back, like, just in my head, the last 30 years, and you can see who is president and who sets kind of the tone. When Obama was president, there was kind of this feeling of optimism and hope. Obviously, Trump brings crazy with him. But underneath Trump, you have your senators and members of Congress who have some influence, not as much influence as Trump, but some. So all of a sudden, Trump is in kind of like persona non grata mode. And instead of these secondary influencers, actual influencers or members of the House and Senate coming out and saying the tough thing, they just relinquish that. So the only voice left in the room, not just the loudest voice, the only voice is Donald Trump and his loudest supporters. And that's where, like, people, if you go into politics as a job, people are relying on you to bring your leadership with you. That's what they hire you for. And if you simply are there to get reelected or to take the easiest route, it's like a car, you know, you're going down the interstate, you make a tiny turn on your steering wheel, it's fine, but eventually you're going to go off the road if you're not correcting it. And that's exactly what happens. And so, you know, you go on Fox News and you're watching Senator Lindsey Graham, who you have some respect for as a base voter, and he says Donald Trump is awesome. He says Donald Trump didn't do anything wrong. You're like, well, I guess he didn't do anything wrong, because everybody I give any trust to all says he didn't. So I was actually surprised, not really, but like looking back, I'm surprised that anybody broke from Donald Trump, because there was nobody besides like me and Liz to say otherwise.
Something that I've noticed between the left and the right, on this thing of like loudest voice in the room following them, can you tell me if you have this impression or if it's true, why does this exist? It feels like on the left, I would say the messaging apparatus is not there. It doesn't exist in terms of this, like, I feel like the right right now has this top down, like, resonant, reverberating, like one thing is said and every part is ringing the exact same tone. Like, an example that I'll always give is if you're watching the news and you hear somebody say something like, this candidate, this leader has horrible messaging, that will only ever be said by a left-wing news host, because on the right, their job is the messaging. Sean Hannity would never say, like, Trump messaged very poorly on this issue. Sean Hannity would message for Trump on the issue. Is there like a... and again, you don't have to expose or whatever, but like, is there like a formal, is there like a big signal group, or is there like a big like email list where it's like, today, this is how we're defending the Preddy thing. This is how we're defending the war in Iran thing. 47 years, guys, everybody get on this talking point. Because I swear there's such uniformity with the messaging. It's insane to me sometimes. Why does that work on the right so well?
Yeah, I mean, and the funny thing is, like, when Obama was president and I was in Congress, we kind of felt like it was the other side. And we're like, the Democrats are so good at messaging and we just fight with each other. Part of it is a function of who Donald Trump is, right? He is hate him or love him, he's a powerful personality, and his messaging can cut through. You know, he says something crazy, and that gives permission for everybody under him to say something crazy. I wish there was a big signal group, because we could infiltrate and disrupt it and expose it. But really, it comes down to when a party has the presidency, they have a huge advantage in all kinds of levels. Then the GOP has built a very solid group of loud influencers, right? You see them on X and everywhere else. They've got, you know, the podcast. You're one of the few highly ranked podcasts on the good side of things. They have so many of the bro podcasts and whatever else. And Donald Trump comes out and makes a statement, and everybody gets their marching orders from that. And so, you know, the other thing, look, Biden, love or hate Biden's presidency, he was not a great messenger, right? Not necessarily in saying what he said, but he was not forceful. His voice didn't cut through. If the Democrats in 2028 can end up settling on a candidate that has solid cutting messages, that is not fake. Can I say this again for a bajillionth time? It's fine if you say something stupid or bad or dumb, as long as you're saying what you believe. Democrats, this is one thing I noticed when I joined the January 6th committee and had my first like real expose into how Democrats operate different than us. They're very poll tested and very scared of offending. And part of that is, you know, obviously Democrats are made up of a bunch of disparate groups with different interests. And so they have to try to keep them together. But this is a time in America where people, I think, value genuineness. They want to know that what you're saying you believe, even if it's, look, Donald Trump is not articulate at all, but he's an effective messenger. And so Democrats will be at this disadvantage, I think, for the next 2.5 years. The key is who is going to be their standard bearer and presidential candidate. And I think you could see that flip. The other thing too is, look, the Republicans have become pretty good at, which is funny because it never was like this. They're pretty good at keeping the circular firing squad generally within the family. Democrats, you know, you have the moderates hate the libs hate the moderates, the, you know, the Israel-Palestine battle going on. Try to keep that in-house, because otherwise you just, you know, look, if you're going to fight with a team in a fist fight, you want everybody fighting the same people, you know?
Yeah, I agree with that. The story I use for that is it always feels like a Republican will walk into a room with 10 different people and try to find one reason for each person to support their candidate. But sometimes it feels like a left person will walk into a room with 10 people and find one reason why everybody shouldn't vote for the left-wing candidate because they're in the right position on something. It's very infuriating sometimes.
Well, and I'll give you another quick example. Like I get sometimes, and it's not much, you know, obviously I'm a basic functionally a Democrat now, and I'll still get occasionally somebody that makes a comment, well, you used to be a Republican or you voted this way before. And I'm like, I'll tell you what, I'm here fighting hard to get Democrats in office. And this is the thing you're going to focus on. Like, if you really believe democracy is at stake, if you really do, we're going to take any ally we can get right now, as long as they're within a moral, right, whatever. If you don't believe democracy is at stake, yeah, then you have the luxury to have differences on every little opinion. But I really think democracy is at stake.
I feel, do you know, have you ever heard of Brad Palumbo?
I've heard the name. I don't know him.
He does YouTube content there. I have like two or three friends who are Republicans who are legitimately stylishly conservative, but they are not they're not Trump supporters. Mm-hmm. And it sucks because in their life, like they are pro-life. They you know, they do have strong conservative beliefs, which is, you know, not good for a group of liberal friends, but you can't be friends with a MAGA person if you're just like a solid, you know, Republican, whatever. So these people are always in the weirdest area of life where all their liberal friends are kind of hoping they'll just join their side, but they're not quite, but then they don't have any other conservative friends. So it's a very awkward position to be in.
It is.
So there's a huge fight right now, kind of in like my circles on the internet. And it'll come to the Democratic Party, you know, if it's not already being discussed, of like, what does it look like to heal or to move forward from the last, it'll be 12 years, because somehow Trump was still, you know, on everybody's minds, even in the 4 years where he wasn't in office. So after Trump is finally out of office, assuming he doesn't run and win for a third term or whatever, right? Like, in terms of moving forward, is it best to forgive and forget and pretend things never happened? Or do there need to be, you know, like large committees? Do we need to bring back the charges for Trump and, you know, go back to the trial stage to actually get to the trial stage for like the January 6th case, the Mar-a-Lago case? In your mind, I guess, where are you or where would you be on that? Like, what do you think is a good, like, should it be retrospective? The Democrats come in and they're like, okay, we got to do something to hold these people accountable. Or should it just be, we just have to build and move forward and not focus on the past? What do you think?
Well, let me tell you what I would do if I was president on day one. The first thing is my first executive order would strip the name Trump from anything, right? Trump Kennedy Center, gone. If Trump built something, gone, unless it's finished, whatever. But then we just rename it. Everything. I would even, and I'm not even joking at this, I would have like, you can send in, because now Trump is signing all the money. You can send in your Trump money and get new money, replaced it from the Treasury. All of it. I will take him down from the Walk of Fame that he put up. I'll put up Joe Biden's real picture, and I will take Trump down. I think we have to erase him from our history. And I mean that only joking, you know, slightly sarcastically. Mm-hmm. Everything he has done has got to be pointed out to the American people that this is absolutely unacceptable. So I'm on the side of swift and severe, within the law, within the Constitution, justice, right? If something has passed the point of, you know, where you can charge somebody with it, we don't want to make up charges. We don't want to find charges for somebody just because we don't like them. But if somebody violated the Constitution, they absolutely should be held accountable to it. If somebody, you know, violated the civil rights of Americans, they absolutely should be held accountable to it. And I'll go a step further. And this is something I think Democrats should be saying right now, and particularly on this part, which is, if you're a foreign government and you are engaged in corrupt practices with President Trump, you will be held accountable for that when he's out of office. Qatar, you're going to give him a $400 million jet for free that the taxpayers spend $1 billion to turn into Air Force One, and then Trump takes it with him. First off, I would seize that asset back as property in the United States. And secondly, I will find out everything that Qatar did and promised, and I will hold them accountable for it. El Salvador, you are putting people, you know, you are putting Americans in jail that don't deserve to be there, you will be held accountable commensurate to that. I think that is essential. We will investigate what were the ties between Russia and Trump. I get it. People hate talking about Trump and Russia, but this dude has never once said anything bad about Vladimir Putin. So the point is, I want to heal the country, and I think we need to heal. But the first step to healing and preventing this from happening again is swift justice. Because if, once again, Merrick Garland, who is, in my mind, probably well-intentioned, but I'm angry at him.
Because, we all are, trust me, yeah.
I can imagine. If he would have started his investigation of Trump when our committee did, and he had far more tools, Trump would be in an orange jumpsuit right now. But he waited. It was literally our first day of hearings when they go, oh, shit, we should probably look into this. And then they started their investigation. It's not like, you know, I love the quote about Abraham Lincoln, malice to none, you know, but that's not this case. And probably looking back at Abraham Lincoln, we probably should have been a little more severe to the Confederacy, because it appears they never truly died.
Do you, when you look at how, let me back up. So I firmly believe that there are things that the public has to be aware of to hold people accountable for. So not voting for people that are, you know, promising to destroy the Constitution or whatever else, you know, exaggerating a bit. But I sometimes feel like there are issues that, unfortunately, the civics knowledge in this country is just not that great. It really wasn't even that great, you know, for me. Like, I didn't really truly learn how presidential elections worked until doing the Jan 6 stuff, right? And like, but man, sometimes, I'm sorry, I don't want to fix it too much on this, but I have doctor friends who are, you know, they're doctors and their families no longer believe in vaccines. And they're like, you're not going to trust anything I say. I can't imagine you, when I talk to people about anything related to the J6 stuff, and it's like electoral certificates, fake slates, what does that mean? And no one has any idea. It's just insane. And the craziest thing too is, like, people believe all these insane conspiracies and everything, but for the J6 stuff, it's all out there, right? And there are so many every deposition with Hirschman, I think, was hilarious. That I want there to be a movie made of that January 3rd meeting in the, I think it was in the Oval, with where they were trying to get Clark to replace as the attorney. There's just so much crazy stuff in there. I'm sorry, but kind of on that, for the civics part, there are some things that I feel like congressmen just have to defend because the public just won't ever really understand it that much. Like, probably nobody, unless you're, you know, a nerd who watches C-SPAN, what is the blue slip rule? Like, nobody knows this. So you kind of need the congressman to be in on defending things. I used to have this feeling that politics was you guys would go out and you kind of say things and they're like a little wacky and it's a little bit performative. But then when the cameras are off, you go behind closed doors and you actually like hammer out legislation. You guys know that you're kind of like performing a bit, but like you have to do the work at the end of the day. And a friend used this term, the mask has melted onto the face now, where I'm not sure if it's any different now. Behind, like I look at the ineffectualness of Congress. Why is the Republican Congress right now so impotent? They have so much leverage in terms of how they could regulate Trump or what they could do to end the IEEPA tariffs or anything else. Why do you think they were so eager to just totally give all of that up?
Yeah, it's amazing because, you know, I try to remind people because, yeah, is Trump authoritarian? Yes. But he's the real fault lies in Congress because Congress could take their power back. Congress could stop the war in Iran if they wanted to. Congress could stop ICE if they wanted to. Why are they so impotent? Because we have replaced, first off, over that 10-year Trump time period, we have created, we just generally have created this environment of fear that exists, right? That fear of being primaried. And let me tell you, if you get on the, as a Republican congressman, if you get on the wrong side of Donald Trump, the literal death threats you get, the anger, the hostility, the friends you lose, because this is a religion now. So this is literally like if you said that Jesus was wrong in Matthew when he said, boom, the Christians wouldn't be too happy with you. This is their religion. And so what does that create? It creates either a, I'm here to be famous, in which case you can if you want, right? Or it creates a, hey, I really care about, I'll just make some air traffic control reform. That's my thing. So I'll go along with all this other stuff as long as I can make my difference in air traffic control reform. And all of those different reasons exist. And then again, what do you do in a cult? How do you create a cult? Well, one of the best things to do is to make an example of people that leave the boundaries. Liz Cheney, me, whoever else, right? We leave, you proverbially execute us in front of everybody, and you say, that will happen to you if you do the same thing. That creates immediately putting them in line. And then Trump is really good at welcoming people back into the fold. I mean, who's Michael Cohen, for God's sakes, who spent the last, you know, Trump's fixer, then spent the last 3 years going after Trump. Now he's got a pro-Trump podcast with Laura Loomer. He's very good at forgiving and bringing you back in the fold. But the rules is, I'll bring you back in the fold, but you can never turn your back on me again. That is a lesson, I think, by the way, that Democrats can learn, which is we have to be willing to bring people into the fold that recognize the errors of their way. Now, they can't come in with excuses. They have to come in and say, yeah, I was wrong. I got a good friend that runs an organization called leavingmaga.org, and it's sounds funny, but it's a support group for people leaving MAGA because you lose all of your social contacts because it's a tribal identity. But I think all of that fear out there and then the incentives, I got to tell you, I Donald Trump knows me well. He was always obsessed with me because he never won me over and it drove him nuts. And he would bring me into the Oval Office, tell me how great I was on television, all this manipulative stuff so that I would be like, oh, I need to impress Donald Trump. He does that very well too. You know, you go, everybody competes to get on Fox News. Even cabinet members compete against each other because if Donald Trump sees you, you might get invited to the Oval Office and you can show somebody that you have his number on your phone and how, I mean, it's pathetic. It's pathetic. And they wear the same freaking shoes, dude. He bought them all shoes and they're wearing, oh, it's a call.
I think I remember when one of the times Biden was walking up the stairs, I think, to Air Force One, I think he had a stumble. And of course, on Fox News, it's like a 3 or 4 or 5 day, you know, news thing until they find the next, you know, trans person to obsess over, whatever. And then I remember Trump had a stumble. I think it was about a year ago. I think Trump had a stumble and Rubio was walking up right after. And then he did a fake stumble to kind of like lighten the mood. And it was like, oh, my God, are we guys? Is this like I wish some days my party had the unity here that that. Somehow the Republicans seem to muster behind every single issue.
You don't want that unity.
No, I know. Yeah, at some point it's too much, but
maybe a taste of it. But dude, listen, I mean, for them to sit around and I know these meetings and it just drives me nuts when they're like, sir, these cabinet, thank you for your leadership. thank you for your leadership. We are so fortunate that you're here. I mean, and he just sits there. If I was president and they were doing that to me, I'd be like, guys, knock it off. I mean, be nice to me and all that. Great, but knock it off.
It's so
pathetic.
And it's so transparent, too. I think that's the thing that bothers me the most. Like, some people are very manipulative in a very sneaky way. But, I mean, you see Trump with the way that he conducts himself with the media, right? Somebody asks him a difficult question. Who are you with? You're a nasty person. Somebody asks a nice question, like, oh, you're so nice. You know, when you put somebody in the room with him who's intelligent, I say intelligent, but just like baseline, you know, like your six-year-old will look at you with puppy dog eyes to manipulate you for a candy bar. I looked at Mamdani speaking to Trump, and I guarantee you, Mamdani probably walked in there with one similar New York experience, and it seems like Trump was just enamored with him immediately and came out, and he was like, oh, you can call me a fascist. It's okay. And I'm like, what? You were just calling this guy a communist like 2 days ago, saying this guy was evil. What happened?
This is the most misunderstood thing about Donald Trump, and I'm glad you brought it up. He is the easiest person to manipulate out there. I mean, this deep depth of narcissism. So I don't know if Russia has anything on him, but I will say at least Putin, who is a KGB agent, knows how to manipulate him. And he'll call him, tell him, oh, you're doing such great things, Donald. Did you know the Ukrainians attacked us? Oh, my God. And then Ukraine has to call, and then Europe has to call. The best thing that happened recently, I mean, it's bad that it had to happen, was Europe has finally started standing up for itself. And what I learned with Donald Trump is if you stand up to him, he respects you more. The second you start dropping to your knees in front of him, he may think he likes it, but he loses all respect for you. I use it as like, you know, when you're a high school kid and you're like a shallow guy when it comes to dating girls, and you like ask a girl to the prom and she says yes, you're like, oh, ugh. And if she says no, you want to go out with her so much more because you're a teenager with a teenage brain. That's who Donald Trump is. So easy to manipulate.
I always think it's funny, too, that like after Trump has a conversation with somebody, it's very obvious like who he's been speaking with. I remember when he was in the U.S. and he started talking about how the border between the United States and Canada is like very straight and it seems kind of arbitrary. And I'm like, this is like such a Putin-esque like talking point about arbitrary border. Like, when have I ever heard somebody speak to the arbitrariness of the border between Canada and the United States? Like, it's like you just got off the call with them and are sharing the ideas with a nation. Yeah.
Or you see the one thing, like, what was it? There was some, Alcatraz. He wanted to, out of nowhere, he's like, we're going to reopen Alcatraz as a prison. And then somebody traced the fact that on cable TV at Mar-a-Lago, the show Alcatraz, the movie Alcatraz was on at the exact moment he tweeted that. So he like saw the movie Alcatraz and it's like, like, dude, oh my God. And he's the president of the most powerful country in the world. That's the frightening thing.
That's one of the things that drives me so insane is when he's doing reports on things, or the White House will publish things, about illegal immigration or whatever else, in the sources, they'll have like Fox News. And I'm like, bro, you have the most information of any individual human being in the history of the entire planet at your fingertips. Why are you going to Fox News for your sources? I remember people would sometimes post like, this is a tweet that Donald Trump makes about some issue. They did this in his first term and they would go back and they would look at what was on Fox and Friends like an hour earlier, and it would just come right from the TV shows.
I mean, the dude got rid of his National Security Council. Generally, basically, it's gone functionally. And somebody had asked him once, "Who's your advisor?" Because my advisors are mainly myself. Okay, dude, I got it. What yourself.
In terms of so one thing that I'm very sympathetic towards, and I feel like this is a very invisible thing to MAGA and then to the entire left, is one of the reasons I feel like it's important to fight against MAGA in a good way, in that you're fixated on just MAGA but not necessarily all conservatives, is because I feel like one of the things that would be helpful if there was a better fight against kind of the MAGA movement isn't just getting rid of MAGA, and it isn't just winning as Democrats, but like as a strong center left to far left person, like I do think it is important to have a strong right wing movement in the country to fight over some policies on. And what do you think, like, are there any Democrats that you feel, or like, what do you think is the strategy for fighting against MAGA in a way that also kind of like carves out space for conservatives, or can that space even be made for conservatives to kind of fight against MAGA kind of with the left, but also still separating themselves from the left because you don't want to be a rhino or anything else? It just seems like such an impossible needle to thread right now.
It is. Look, I would love to have a third party. I would love it. It's not going to happen, but I would love it because it gives flexibility to work together, to create alliances. one of the things I think, as I advise Democrats, that I think Democrats can do to be the party that's never defeated again is to make space for conservative Democrats again. And you're not going to agree with them on stuff. But listen, I live in Texas now. A conservative Democrat has a better shot at winning in Texas than your typical kind of cookie cutter left wing Democrat, because it's a Republican state. Now, that doesn't mean I think they should run conservative Democrats in New York City. It's like, it is much better to fight in the tent your policy differences and actually be able to have policy differences. Whereas with what the right wing is taking us down, you're not going to be able to have a difference with the president eventually. You're not going to be able to rightfully have your own opinions. And so I think it's, and even if it's not like, I'm not talking hardcore conservative Democrats, because that's just, it's just different than who Democrats are, but like center right, there's got to be space, even if they don't run, just to like join the team, right, and help vote and see what the bigger picture is. I don't think there's much more. Like, I think MAGA is just going to have to be crushed for the GOP to have like kind of a come to Jesus moment, to realize that this isn't going to work, because there's nothing like losing that wakes people up. But the other thing is this, and this is just a piece of advice, is as Democrats, and I'm not, again, I'm separating MAGA here. So MAGA to me is not part of this. I don't even consider them small L liberal at all. They're illiberal. But among conservative thinkers, thoughtful conservative thinkers, you actually want conservatives to have a role in government, because what I've learned, and this is the benefit of having been in politics a while, the benefit of leaving my party and being able to see things kind of anew, is like, it's important to have forces that hold stuff back, and it's important to have forces that push forward when you're uncomfortable. And that dance between progressiveness pushing forward and conservative kind of like, whoa, let's think this through, actually leads to the proper, I think, advancement of society. Not always, we don't always get it right, but I think generally that works. And so respecting conservative thinkers and taking them into account, not necessarily having to believe them, but recognizing they're part of the process, is brilliant. Because trust me, if you start getting rid of anything on the right, you've just made basically Donald Trump. It's just a left-wing version of it, and it's not as fun as you might think it would be.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Well, hey, thanks so much for chatting.
Yeah, this was great.
One more random personal question. I just think it's so funny how much crossover there is between, well, it's horrible, between the online world and the Washington world now. One thing that I appreciated a lot that I grew to hate maybe more than almost any other thing as a semi-public figure was whenever there was some bad stuff going down involving you, where there was a ton of heat on you, sometimes you would get people that would, they'd send you a message privately. They'd say, hey, listen, I really support what you're doing. Like, I really appreciate you. Like, good job. And at first I was like, this is awesome. Or it feels good to get those messages. Like, thanks, I appreciate the support. But then at some point I'm like, why are you messaging me this privately? If you want to support me, do something about it. Say something publicly. Like, I got 20 people privately, but then you're on an island publicly. Yeah, do you ever have that feeling, I guess, for the...
Yes.
Okay.
There's two things that piss me off. Number one is that. It's like, I mean, I'm glad when people message me good things, but if they're like, I'd have so many people, I'm glad you're saying it. I can't say it because my district, I wouldn't get it. I'm like, dude,
you can't say conservative. It.
Yeah, I can't either. Yeah. And then it's that. And then the thing, so I'm very strict with my friends. Like, I'm happy to talk politics, but politics doesn't come into our friendship. Because I have, 50-50 left and right. I've had people like my co-pilot in the war when I was in Iraq that sent me a text and said, I'm ashamed to have ever flown with you. And the thing, it's like, yeah, that's hurtful to get. But I'm like, why? You woke up this morning and you thought, I am going to send Adam this text to hurt him. You're not going to influence me. I'm not going to be like, oh, shit, I should change my mind. That is like, I don't understand the brain rot in people where they're just dropping grenades, destroying relationships over politics.
I agree. Well, thanks a ton for the chat. I hope we see more of you in the future. Great. I hope we chat more in the future. And yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to do it. I'd love to come back. Thanks.
Cool. Good luck with everything. Yeah. Do you want, real quick, do you have a book? You said you're working on a future podcast. Anything you want to plug while people are listening?
Well, look, actually, the big thing is my Substack. So go to my adamkinzinger.substack.com. I put out one today about how we're not prepared for military conflict that's actually coming our way. Mm-hmm. And I got a children's book coming out. It's called That's What Heroes Do. I don't have a copy here, but it's good. It's really good, actually, and I'm not just saying it because it's my book.
Awesome. So, I'll buy it and I'll put it next to my Kash Patel trilogy for the King and the Hillary Clinton and all that. So cool.
Yeah, perfect.
Thanks for the time for the chat. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet. Take care. Bye.